Coming up on Boston Public Radio, would you lose weight or stop smoking if your employer paid you for it? Well, a provision in the Affordable Care Act makes that much more likely. We'll get your take on it. Then Globe editor Brian McGrory joins us, followed by an early edition of a holiday-themed Emily's List with Emily Rooney.
The Reverend Tim Skank on finding God in Christmas chaos. That's the theme of his new book, Dog in the Manger. Then for all you last-minute shoppers, food writer Corey Kummer is here to tell us about the very best cookbooks of 2013. That's all coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Marjorie Egan, you're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. How many shopping days left till Christmas, Jim?
So glad you ask every day and never know. Today I calculated seven, Marjorie. Seven.
How are you doing?
Days left. I'm done. Now, I'm really done, trust me. So for all the attention the Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as Obamacare, has gotten, one provision that has been overlooked is the financial incentive that the law allows employers to offer its workers. Employers have the financial means under the act to reward those at a greater level, by the way, who improve their health. For example, they stop smoking, they lose weight, they lower their blood pressure. So our question for you at 877-301-8970 is quite simple. Would a financial incentive, otherwise known as cash, motivate you to be healthier? Is this what you need to jumpstart a healthier lifestyle? Let me read you, Marjorie, the opening of Tracy Jan's piece in the Globe. Would $1,700 a year, it's a lot of money, motivate you to drop a few pounds? How about $3,000 to quit smoking? That's how much, on average, the government is allowing employers to reward their workers beginning in January of 2014 for doing things like I described. Again, the number is 877-301-8970. I am so for this, I cannot see straight. I mean, it is money. The whole
Absolutely.
Cash on the barrel, as the saying goes, I think would motivate a lot of people to do things that they shouldn't need other incentive to do, but that probably they do.
I think what it would motivate me to do is to start smoking again so that I could quit smoking and make the $3,000.
I would, you know, it's funny you say that.
We have to get to details. Do you only can you smoke a couple of New Year's Eve parties? You're out and you've had maybe a little bit too much champagne and be the cocktail party smoker. Can you smoke for 2 weeks and then quit? I mean,
By the way, that you're making light of that. I, as you know, have smoked one cigarette my whole life. What if I started smoking in January, as you say, purely to stop?
Right. I'm going wild over the Christmas holiday season, Jim. Then I'm going to quit smoking in January and make $3,000.
Here's some stats for you from this piece in the Globe. Fewer than 10% of the firms which already have wellness programs use what's called results-based financial incentives, meaning it's some firms, a ton of firms, for example, poor choice of words. A lot of firms say if you go have a certain kind of physical or some sort of analysis of all the factors in your body, they'll give you a certain amount of money. It's not a results-based thing. This, which is slightly more controversial because some people say it actually discriminates against them at the workplace if they don't do certain things, if they don't engage in healthier behaviors, which they may choose not to do, this says it's based on results. It's watered down in some companies that say if you try hard, if you go through some sort of program to lose weight and you don't lose as much to get the maximum amount of money, you can get something. We want to talk straight on. If they say to you, just pick a number, if you lose 5% of your body weight, you get $1,700. Are you not much more likely to lose 5% of your body weight?
There's
I would say yes.
The yo-yo factor here, where you lose 5% of your body weight, put it back on, or lose it again, put it back on. You know, if you did that three
Which
times
I have
in
done.
A year,
yes. Thanks,
you could
Margaret.
Be up to $9,000.
You know what I just realized? You know, I think I misrepresented the discrimination thing. I assumed when I said a minute ago the discrimination thing was people who either are overweight or smoke and mm-hmm. say, listen, I'm happy doing what I'm doing. I just realized it discriminates against healthy people. I don't mean illegally discriminates.
Well, it doesn't really.
No, let me finish the thought for a second. Let's assume you aren't overweight. Let's
right.
assume you don't smoke. You're not able to take advantage of these incentives.
Well, the story does point out that overall healthy workers are paying more because they're paying the premiums for what their unhealthy workers cost
them. So the theory is that indirectly, if their coworkers get healthier, the premiums
out, yeah,
are going to go down for everybody.
Out. Anyway, I don't think that most people would say if you are in good shape, for $1,700, would you want to like gain 20 pounds and start smoking?
No, I was kidding about that.
Okay. All right. By the way, I want to point out this EMC Corporation. If things don't work out at your present job, you might try applying to EMC there in Hopkinton.
What are they doing?
Well, they encourage their healthy eating. And what they do is they encourage people to take swimming, yoga, I guess they got a pool, and meditation during lunch. And just for participating in the activities, things like getting flu shots and meeting with a lifestyle coach, they get a 20% discount on their health insurance premiums. That's a pretty good deal.
That's pretty good. And that's not the results-based thing either. It's a process thing. Is EMC the place in the story that when you go to the salad bar at work, things that are healthy have a green spoon or
correct.
Green tongs.
Color-coded.
Things that are unhealthy, meaning stop, have red.
That's right. Red for blue cheese dressing and bacon bits and green for vegetables.
877-301-8970. What do you think about these results-based initiatives at your workplace? And again, as Marjorie said a minute ago, the reason for the Affordable Care Act, including this, is because the theory, which is not a theory, the notion is that if there is a healthier workforce, by definition, insurance premiums are going to go down for the employer. So the employer benefits and obviously the worker benefits if he or she chooses a more healthy lifestyle. I have to say, if there's a lawyer out there who understands better than I have described this whole fear of discrimination lawsuits that apparently are causing concern amongst a number of employers who have been doing this kind of thing to a lesser degree even before the Affordable Care Act. Apparently, under existing law, a certain percentage of your premiums could be affected if you had these results-based initiatives, and now it can be up to somewhere near 30%. Apparently, there is a provision, though, that says, doesn't it say in that story, Marjorie, if you stop smoking, which I guess they consider to be the most dramatic thing, the premiums can be cut as much as 50%.
Yeah,
50%
it does.
Is huge. 877-301-8970. One, do you have anything like this at the company where you work? And number two, whether you do or not, are you the kind of person who said, yeah, I've never been able to lose those pounds despite all the New Year's resolutions. I'm still smoking. My cholesterol's atrocious. All these kind of things. Would money make a difference?
Let's go to, is it Stretch? Hi, Stretch from Dorchester.
Hey, Stretch. What's going on?
Hey, I think you guys are onto something. I think it would augment the Obamacare Act. Unbelievable if they would send out a check to people that go to work every day and pay for people that aren't EBT if they stay in shape.
I was guessing, I had a bet with Marjorie, we would take three calls to get to the EBT call, but I was off by two. We got it on the first one. Stretch, thanks for your contribution. We appreciate it. 877-301-8970. You know, particularly in tough economic times, I don't mean to sing the praises of this more than it deserves. It is such, to me, such an obviously good idea. And I'm sure someone will call and say, I'm missing something, which I welcome. But I love this. And it's also a win-win-win. It's good for the employer. They have healthier workers. Their health care costs are reduced. And it's good, obviously, for the employee who's going to live probably longer and better.
You know what I was surprised at, too? How many of these companies already do offer financial rewards just for participating in these healthy activities. This story says 81%. These are big companies, by the way, the ones that can afford to have a fitness center on site and stuff like that.
Wasn't there a big controversy? Is it mentioned? I can't remember in the story about CVS saying if you went and had certain testing done or something.
Oh, yeah. Well, some companies have gotten in trouble, and CVS was one of them. They had problems in March when they told employees who did not go through a confidential health screening that measured height, weight, body fat, blood pressure, glucose, and body lipids that they'd pay a $600 hike in their insurance premiums.
So there's a penalty there as opposed to a reward.
Apparently, employees did not like that. I don't think they got far with that proposal.
How do you feel about that? I mean, you are quite a healthy person. So there's not. I'm trying to think other than an occasional cigarette outside a cocktail party.
You don't have
any behaviors that you can get rewarded for.
I used to be a cocktail party smoker, but there's no one to bum cigarettes off anymore.
Because
almost no one smokes, so I can't be.
So this is an abstract thing for you because you wouldn't. What would you think?
I mean, I could exercise more. Hey, it's a great thing. The Herald used to have a health center right in the building with showers, so it was great. You could go down at lunchtime, you could go to an aerobics class, or you could go to a yoga class, take a shower, and come back to work. It was great. And if you felt just like you were kind of 3 o'clock in the afternoon starting to fall asleep or you're losing your energy, it's amazing how if you could down, forget even working out, just going down and taking a shower. So it was great. It was absolutely terrific.
Have you ever used the pool here at GVH?
I've not used the pool here at
it's
GVH.
Fabulous.
We do have the New Balance.
There's
health
no pool,
center.
By the way. Just
we do have a New Balance,
but that's not part of
GBA.
It's down the block.
Yeah, but I think you get a cut rate to join.
I know you do,
which is pretty good.
It's a nice thing. I agree.
Okay, Beth from Chelmsford, what do you think, Beth?
Well, the health plan that I'm on actually has, they give you money towards your deductibles for not smoking, for walking. We have pedometers. And actually, even you see people talking about it, I think it works. I think it's great. And actually, I think the whole thing started with companies trying to charge for unhealthy and realized they couldn't. So they switched it to this, and I think it's an excellent incentive. I don't need to lose weight. I was already not a smoker, but I actually have been getting money because I am healthy and because I've been walking and wearing my pedometer.
So what do you do?
It's good overall.
Do you hand in your pedometer to your supervisor at the end of the week so he knows you're really walking, or she knows?
Virgin Health, which is the same as Branson, you know, all this Virgin company.
Yep.
They have a website, and you hook your pedometer directly to your computer. It downloads all the information, and it starts giving you points. And if you do things, like I'm a big cyclist, so if I don't have my pedometer on me when I'm cycling, I can still log that in. I can lift weights and log that in as additional activity.
Wow.
What's roughly, how much money do you save or get if you're doing an awful lot of walking in a particular month? What's the range, Beth?
Well, it's up to $200 a year, and then for not smoking is $50 a year, and there's a health assessment that is another, I don't even know. But it all goes to a fund to pay your deductible, so I can't tell you the last time I paid a deductible.
Now, Beth, before you go away, you say you're a pretty healthy person, pretty good
like
shape.
She sounds like a total physical specimen.
How about your coworkers who are not total physical specimens, to use Marjorie's name? How do they feel about this program? Are they using it to a great degree? Are they happy about it? Do they feel it's unfair towards them, or what's their take?
Actually, I'm on my husband's health care because he has this. My company doesn't.
Oh, okay.
But when I've been at parties and events, the people who aren't as in good shape, like they joke around when I ride my bike, could you carry my pedometer? But they'll pull out the pedometer. They're like, I've been walking. I've been trying. It is in their mind. I think it brings it more more in your thoughts on everything you do, but in a positive, rewarding way.
And I agree with you.
They don't seem to have a problem at all with it.
Beth, thank you so much for the call. You know, Beth touched on something I was going to say once she hung
What's
up,
that,
and
Jim?
She said friends jokingly say, can you carry my pedometer? I'm thinking for a minute. If you get $200, you find somebody who's really athletic, you give them $100, have them walk around like crazy.
Exactly.
And then you turn in the pedometer. I mean, you sort of it's a win-win for you and your good friends. Your
somehow
friends.
I don't see you joining in with your fellow employees to do a little brisk walk around the WGBH building.
Actually, you know, I used to. I don't anymore. I used to park my car in the farthest corner of the parking lot because she's laughing if you can't hear, because every little bit helps. You know, you read these things, Marjorie, every little bit does
every
help.
Every little bit helps. That's correct, Jim. And Jim has been the last couple of days in that practice because of the snow, but he's got his Yak Tracks today.
I do.
Those little studs on the bottom of your shoes,
studs,
and you
little
kind
spikes.
Of yeah, little
they
spikes,
are.
And you can zip right across.
At our prior employer,
the parking lot.
I turned in my pedometer, and they said we don't have that program. So it was really, it was truly unfortunate. I love that, Paulina. You're in Framingham. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Thanks so much for your call.
Well, thank you so much for letting me on. It's so frustrating for healthy people. To people who aren't doing these things to feel penalized. I don't understand why we aren't having folks pay more premiums for doing the unhealthy things and incentivizing them by you can save money by doing these healthy things.
Well, some do. As you know, smokers, if you check that you're a smoker, it obviously affects in virtually all circumstances. Doesn't it affect your insurance premium or at least the share you pay?
Oh, I mean, that's good. But what I keep hearing is that everybody's paying these premiums and that people are really relying on the healthy people to pay for the people who are not so healthy.
Well, that's the basic premise
actually.
Behind insurance, despite what I said. You are right. But, Paulina, you were who we're looking for. You're obviously a fit person who sort of, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you sort of resent the fact that other people need to be compensated for what you do for nothing. Is that where you're coming from?
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah.
I guess so. And the frustrating part is that healthcare is very, very, very expensive. It's more sick care than it is healthcare. And
that's a good point too.
But Paulina, you could be the healthiest person in the world today and tomorrow come down with a dread disease. You know, that's the thing.
Here's the thing. It's true. I mean, do I think we need healthcare, like true healthcare? Yes, I think we do. I think that the price is way too high because people just keep charging more and more and more, as opposed to, you know, if there was less money, maybe the price of some outrageous things would come down. And if people were doing more to be healthy, and being incentivized by maybe saving money as opposed to giving the money. But whatever, combination of the two is fine.
Well, you know, Pauline, I hear your concerns, and I just think some creative incentive thing that makes everybody healthier. At the end of the day, everybody benefits, including people like you who have been wise enough to take care of yourself. And thank you, Paulina, for the call. I understand
where
that.
Where do we rank now? Are we the second fattest nation on
after
Earth?
Mexico.
Or
we were number one for years.
Now,
I actually am obsessed with this. No, Qatar.
Whoops.
We were number one for years.
I thought it was Qatar.
Then Qatar passed us.
Qatar.
And then we passed Qatar again. I know it's shocking that
well,
I actually know this.
Qatar.
And then Mexico passed us.
What do people wear in Qatar?
Are those robes?
Those robes.
So, you can't tell.
If you can wear robes all day long, you know, who knows
really
how
right.
enormous you've gotten. And I think that was the thing with Qatar. They were a lot of robed men who were also sitting in fast food joints in Qatar and smoking like furnaces.
Let me ask you something. If you believed, we'll get back to the calls in a second. If incentives like this, financial
yep.
incentives, again, as they're called, results-based financial incentives, meaning if you can produce an outcome on a whole variety of things, like stopping smoking, like losing X number of pounds, if they were available to everybody, do you not think we would be a wildly healthier society than we are now? I mean, Pauline is right. We shouldn't need it, but we do need it. We need something to get us off the dime. You don't think that would have a tremendous impact on the health of all Americans or most Americans?
I don't know anybody who smokes who wants not to quit. I mean, people want to quit smoking. Nobody enjoys being overweight. That's why after January 1st, you always see, you know, the big influx. Everybody's going to yoga classes or gym classes because it's one of their New Year's resolutions. I'm going to lose 20 pounds. I'm going to quit smoking. So people really do want it. I think the more incentives you can give people, the better. And $3,000 to quit smoking is no
decent,
small piece of change. You could take a nice trip somewhere.
You know what you mentioned January 1st when everybody does this thing.
That's always shocking to go to Disney World.
What's that? I know. Well, I mean, it's symptomatic of what is wrong with the health of America. I mean, we don't have to go into the details. By the way, other than this year, for obvious reasons, because
why
of
not?
The horror on April 15th, what usually happens after Marathon Day? I lived in New York City the day after the New York City Marathon.
Everybody's,
historically, up until this year, the day after the Boston Marathon, people who you look at them and you say, if they run, and I used to be amongst them, if you run more than 100 yards, you're going to be in the ER in about 2 minutes. Everybody is running. And why is that? Because there's a psychological incentive the day before because you see fit people. So let's make it financial. I love this. And by the way, if you just tuned in, the reason we're talking about this is a front page story in the Globe. A little known provision in the Affordable Care Act allows employers to save more on their premiums. It increases the amount if they provide incentives for their workers to be healthier. So the worker benefits and the employer benefits, theoretically, in terms of premiums.
You know, George just emailed, and our email address, by the way, is bpr@wgbh.org, and he's talking about the slippery slope issue. He's concerned that employers could start adding more and more incentives to essentially force their employees into whatever lifestyle they want. For example, start offering incentives to eat vegan or to quit drinking, and then to justify that, you know, to intrusively check up on their employees as well.
Well, that's the paternalism that Tracy Jan mentions in her story. But you know what the solution to that is? Don't take the money. If the behavior that they are incenting, I hate that as a verb, if the behavior they're incenting is one that you don't want to engage in, then don't engage in it. I mean, isn't that a pretty obvious solution to the problem?
You have to pay a lot of money, I think, for a lot of people to
become vegan.
Yeah.
You need enough money that you can go out and buy a steak. Let's have... on the sly, of course. Let's go to Joe and Needham. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Jim and Marjorie. Hi there, Joe.
Hi. Been listening, and I'm totally against the incentive theory.
Why?
I think that if they want to do anything, they should start with a psychologist or a psychiatrist. That's number one. That's better put their money because of behavioral modification. Secondly, I think that it starts with getting rid of places like McDonald's and Arby's and Dunkin' Donuts and places that make you fat. And that's where it's got to start. And also with the kids today.
Well, virtually every part you said except for the Dunkin' Donuts part I was perfectly fine with because Marjorie and
just
I
there today.
Had a little bit of a...
In fact, we were there yesterday as well.
But you know, the point that Joe raises about behavioral modification, which we haven't talked about, and Joe, thanks for the call, is ultimately if you do something and you do it in a crash sort of way to make the $3,000 or the $1,500 for whatever, the likelihood is good is you're going to undo that. And that's what's interesting about this, by the way. I'm assuming, we hadn't talked about this at all, and we should check it out, is... is there some provision that says if you lose weight and get to the goal and you get your X $1,000, you got to keep that weight for a year?
I don't know.
If you stop smoking and you get your check, you can't start smoking again a month later, or you have to repay this thing?
Yo-yo,
I mean, that's what she's talking about.
The yo-yo diet.
Well, I've said it 1,000 times, I've done the yo-yo thing with weight, which, by the way, you know, most doctors say it is far more unhealthy to go – it is far – better to be a little bit overweight and stay there, even though that isn't a recommended thing. If the alternative is not fitness, but the alternative is you lose 20, you gain 30, you lose 30. The yo-yo thing apparently wreaks havoc on
it
your
does?
Body. Yeah.
Well, you're still here.
I just lost a lot, but I mean, it's up and down, which is not. Let's take one more quick one.
Sean, Richard in Arlington. Sorry.
Hey, Richard.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Hi.
I'm very much in favor of the financial incentives, and for example, with automobiles and that insurance, we have assigned risk pools, right, for people who are high risks.
That's a very good point. Good drivers.
Why couldn't we do something like that?
Well, essentially, don't you think that's what this is? This is I've used the term 15 times because it's a term of art. It's a results-based incentive. Right. And obviously, you get points and you pay more. If you're a poor driver, that's a penalty. But you also have points disappear. I am currently experiencing exactly that on my auto insurance because I haven't had an accident in a couple of years, which I guess is a positive results-based alternative. That's essentially what they're talking about in terms of health. Now, Richard, thank you for the call. Sean, since Marjorie uttered your name.
I did.
Even though it was totally unintentional.
Order.
We'll finish with you. Sean from Dedham, take it away.
Jimmy and Marjorie, how are you today? Marjorie, thank you. I loved when I heard my name. that gave me a little Christmas.
Yeah, right. I'm sorry. I was supposed to go in order, Sean, and I made a mistake.
Go ahead, Sean.
I have her flummoxed, Jimmy. The lead incentive should be to live a productive life. I mean, don't give them money. I mean, throw their TVs out the window. Give them small refrigerators. Tell the fatty, like, Jimmy, you were a fatty when you were a kid.
We don't call it a fatty. I was overweight when I was a little.
Husky, Jimmy.
There are rumors that my mother, I've mentioned this, did not walk me to school, but she rolled me to school. And I think there is some legitimacy. I had a few more pounds on the old body than I should have when I was a little child. Is that your point, Sean?
Yes, sir, it is. But the bottom line is, do we want to live a life when you get into your 50s and 60s, walking around with a walk or a wheelchair and have medications on your bureau? Or do you want to maybe get outside and walk?
Exactly. But Sean, essentially, your connection's horrible, so sadly we have to get rid of you. That's exactly what they're doing. They want the same endpoint you do, and the Affordable Care Act is making it easier for employers to reward employees who engage in healthy behaviors and get healthy outcomes.
I'm wondering what the opponents to the Affordable Care Act will have to say about this, as the more publicity it gets, this portion of it gets.
Did you know about this before today?
I did not know.
And by the way, employers can spend some money. This just ups the amount of money they can provide in incentives to make it more worthwhile for the employee.
Before we move on, isn't it incredible that here we are, however long we are into the Affordable Care Act,
I'm so glad you said this.
Today,
I'm so glad
we learned about this provision inside it. I mean, it's just crazy. We have no idea really what the Affordable Care Act says, do we? It's just crazy.
Do you think when Obama said months ago that you can keep on those extra pounds if you want to, he wasn't telling us the truth? Is that what it was?
I don't know. When we come back, we're going to check in with the editor of the Boston Globe, Brian McGrory, and a bunch of stories in his paper this week. That conversation next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She would be Marjorie Egan. He, who joins us every single Wednesday, would be Brian McGrory, editor of the Boston Globe. Hello, Brian.
Hello, Jim Browdy. Hello, Marjorie. How are you?
Hello, Brian McGrory. I'm very, very well. So, Brian, on Monday we had Patty Wenden here to talk about your great piece on the Tsarnaev brothers. And yesterday we had medical ethicist Art Kaplan talking about, Patty Wenden's been very busy, about another piece she did about Children's Hospital.
With Neil Swarty.
Yes, and the hospital on very, very shaky grounds, if you ask me, taking custody of a teenage girl for nearly a year in the psychiatric ward there. And then today, we'd like to talk to you about a couple more things that you've been doing, Brian, so it's good for you at the Boston Globe today. Let's start with Billy Baker's piece about the two young kids from Dorchester. Tell us about that story.
Well, it's extraordinary. So a couple of years ago, the Globe—thank you, by the way, Marjorie, for all that. A couple of years ago, the Globe did a project on a bus route through Dorchester, and kind of followed who rides that bus, what it means, the kind of lifeline that it is. And Billy came across some young brothers who were not from an ideal home life, who were, you know, left too much on their own to make their own way. And Billy wrote about them very poignantly. And one of them went off to UMass Amherst. Billy had, who's a terrific Globe reporter, had stayed in touch with them, had actually become something of a mentor to them. And this week, one of them, the younger of the two brothers, George, was accepted at Yale. And it's a big deal, very, very big deal. And so Billy very cleverly went out and did a narrative story via Twitter two nights ago, and the thing caught fire immediately. It was flung all around the world. He got offers to appear on what's his name? Is it Piers Morgan?
Piers Morgan.
What's
Jim adores Piers Morgan.
I don't
watches him every
adore.
Night.
He's good on guns, but go ahead, Brian.
Jim adores him because he gets great ratings and that kind of thing, I'm sure.
But, he's a good guest. That's what it's about.
So half the media world, I don't know if Broadside has, but half the media world has reached out to Billy Baker to be on, as well as George, and it's become quite the phenomenon.
Well, yeah. A couple of things. The family came from Vietnam. The father had a terrible time there, severe PTSD, jumped off the Tobin Bridge,
yes.
And the mother has mental health issues. So you had two kids with parents that were both, one of them gone completely and one of them struggling and living in very tough circumstances. I mean, it's a phenomenal story. And Emmett Folgert from the Dorchester Youth Collaborative, who's got to be 60 years old by now, has been working with kids over there for 40 years, and he got these kids for Billy, and he's gotten kids for many of us, and he's a great guy. He deserves a lot of credit, too.
Well, Emmett Folgert is a saint, and what he does over there is just incredible work. And he put Billy together with these brothers. And I mean, the scary part of this, Marjorie, is there are more families like that than we realize in these neighborhoods. And you know, these two were very fortunate in that they had somebody like Emmett, they had somebody like Billy. Their story was told. They are going to do very well in life, but there are too many others that just slipped through the cracks.
Nolly's a beautiful story. Let me just read you the first couple of lines if any of you have missed this. Just after 5 p.m. Monday, the text message popped up on my phone. I got in. I was sitting at my desk in the Globe newsroom, and I started crying. It is a totally great story.
You know what else, on a lighter note? I mean, is not Billy Baker one of the great bylines of all times? You know, you said yourself, okay, Brian McRoy, it's okay. Marjorie Egan, it's okay. But Billy Baker, it's great.
It's a great byline. He's also he's an extremely talented writer, as you guys know.
Yeah, he's very good. I'm glad he's not William Baker. I like the whole Billy thing. It's got a certain...
What's his real name? Where did he change it from, Brian? Do you know?
That's such a cynical question.
Hey, Brian, just a couple of quick things about the pieces, the series in the case of the children's thing and this mini book that was done on the filling in many of the blanks on the Tsarnaev brothers. When you do a story like the children's story, a children's hospital story yesterday, and this young kid and her essentially being taken away from her parents unilaterally, and I would argue without due process, because of a disagreement among doctors and hospitals, what role do lawyers play before something like that is available to the reader? It's huge, right?
Well, they play a significant role. We had two different lawyers read that both days of that two-part series front to back a couple of different times in a couple of different stages of development, and they had some comments. We made some minor changes because of their comments. But, yeah, obviously we're dealing with a very powerful institution in Children's Hospital and, you know, an institution that most of the time does extraordinary work for a whole lot of people. And in this case, you know, it looked like, well, it was a case worth throwing some light on. And I think that Neil Swidey and Patty Wen, along with their editor Gideon Gill, who also did quite a bit of work on the story. For my money, it was one of the better things we've done this year.
Another great name, Gideon Gill. This is in any case. One last thing.
I love those alliterative things.
About what they are, actually, that's a fine point. One last thing about the Tsarnaev thing, which has driven me absolutely out of my mind in a whole set of settings. Anytime people like the three people who wrote, Patty Wen and David Filipov and Sally Jacobs, write like they did, or whether it's somebody describing Adam Lanza in Newtown or the shooter in Aurora or whenever, people do research, and including 5 months of research like your reporters do, and come up with a major mental health component, the knee-jerk lunacy. I've been listening to talk radio on some other stations, which I probably should not have done in the wake of that Tsarnaev thing. If I hear one more person say, well, I have mental illness. My nephew has mental illness. He hasn't shot anybody. He didn't put bombs on Boylston Street. Does that drive you as crazy as it drives me?
Well, look, thank you for your comments on that story, Patty. Patty Wen again, David Filipov, and Sally Jacobs did extraordinary work along with their equally alliterative editor, Mark Morrow.
This is unbelievable.
I think it's important in the journalism business to have an alliterative name.
You've changed everything at the Globe, Brian.
It's how we hire.
It's important.
You
want to have a catchy name.
I mean, this was three elite reporters, a terrific editor along with Jen Peter, the Metro editor, who did months of work. We went to Dagestan. We were all over the East Coast here looking for information. We have done at the Globe exhaustive stories on the victims of the bombing, rightfully so. We made a decision very early on that we're going to concentrate on the victims because that's really what the story was all about. The medical community, the first responders, the investigation into this. But it was also very important that we provide as clear an answer as we could as to the level of depravity and the roots of the depravity and criminality of the two people who caused this. So we set out many months ago, put our three elite reporters on this to try to come up with some answers. It's called journalism, and we publish that this week. Some people, what I would think is a very narrow minority, don't necessarily love the answers or the information that we uncovered.
I hope it's a narrow minority, but
it's not a minority at Marjorie's paper. But we'll leave that one alone because I think that's kind of embarrassing this week what's gone on over there. But
well, hold on for 1 second, Brian. I think if you saw yesterday's paper, I think we could call it was fair and balanced. Howie Carr was going after you, and I was on doing the other side. And the day before that...
Do you think your editorial was fair and balanced?
I'm sure you disagree with editorials at your paper from time to time as well. And I sometimes disagree
that
with editorial, the Herald's
editorial. The editorial was a joke. The editorial was an absolute joke. And you wrote a terrific column. Howie Carr, I don't think, has gotten up off his couch in Wellesley in years. we at the Globe do real live reporting. And we do it with very, very good reporters. We do it with very good editors. And the funny part about this is we showed that Zhahar Tsarnaev was a much different character than what initial reports might have realized. He was a leader more than a follower. He was not apparently intimidated by his brother. We didn't see that he was suffering from any major mental health issues. And it kind of put him in new light that... I think is important to understand as we head toward a possible trial.
Well, that to me was the most fascinating part here, because it remains unclear, and maybe it'll come out in the trial, and maybe we'll never know, and maybe this kid doesn't know himself, how he went from a little stoner down at UMass Dartmouth to without any apparent mental health issues, without being the dupe of his brother that we thought he was, and that's a defense strategy that's going to be blown out of the water.
Anti-death penalty strategy that's going to be blown out of the water.
How he went from that to walking down Boylston Street with bombs on his back, it is unbelievable. That's the incredible question that's left hanging.
And
how does
I don't
happen?
Think we'll ever. I don't think we'll ever know that. That will be a tough one to get to. Maybe federal prosecutors in the FBI have had more luck than we did. We'll find that out at the trial. But the jump is extraordinary.
You put me in a difficult position, Brian. You know that.
Did you read the edit? By the way, the editorial.
Audrey, you know I don't mean to, and let me circle back. Your column was terrific.
That's why I baited that.
Can
that
I ask a question? I'm embarrassed.
I really appreciate that.
I don't want to get into it. I didn't read the reason I didn't weigh in on this. Not that it was my business. I didn't read the Herald editorial that you were.
There's this thought, and I disagree with it, obviously. But there's this thought that some people have that when you look at anything in detail that in any way seems to excuse, which I don't think you were doing.
We weren't excusing anything.
Exactly,
but that was the point I was trying to make about mental health, as if when you when one gets to the bottom of mental health issues that arguably caused someone to kill 26 and 7-year-olds and 6 adults plus his mother, or the Tsarnaev brothers, particularly in the case of the elder Tsarnaev, it's as if the journalists who are doing the reporting are excusing the behavior. It is moronic.
But the other thing is, and we had Patty Nguyen in here this week, and she was talking about the relationship she's had since the bombing itself, and she was interviewed her at the hospital the night of the bombing with Liz Norden. Liz Norden was complaining in the Herald about the stories, but I think in her case, I mean, I'm not going to she's the mother of the two young men that lost their legs. Both her sons lost their legs. It's hard for any victim, I think, in some cases, to see anything about these young men that caused such grief to her family. So I would give Liz Norden a huge pass for whatever she has to say.
Oh, God, yes.
About
I completely
it.
Get it. You're exactly right, Marjorie. If you were affected in an intimate way by these bombings her case, both two sons lost legs, parts of legs. It would be almost impossible to read this stuff.
But, exactly.
But look, that doesn't mean that we don't do it. And keep in mind the context in which we did it. This paper has developed significant relationships with victims across the boards for a very simple reason. We have covered their plight exhaustively and in a very real way. We devoted ourselves from the early days of this bombing to telling their stories and making sure that everybody understood the true impact of these bombings. So we had a front-page story about the Norden brothers on April 16th, the morning after the bombings. Patty Nguyen had met Liz Norden in a waiting room at one of the hospitals.
She mentioned that to us on the air on Monday. She said she met her that afternoon.
And I would also say at the Herald, Peter Galzinis, Aaron Smith, Erica Moore, a lot of reporters at the Herald have done a lot of stories about the victims as well.
I agree.
Hey, Brian, I want to talk about a story that I think your editors, Dave Davison and Philip Phillipson, worked on, if I'm correct. Is that – maybe it's the wrong story.
So who says Jim's not clever?
When you read the story this morning – morning about, which is not funny, so I should calm down for a second. When you read the story, even though there is an odd part of it, about this 20-year-old kid allegedly, moronically again, sending, if not criminally, this email at Harvard that caused the exams to be canceled and buildings to be evacuated. You know what the first thought people in the newsroom had was? That he hadn't read the story in the Boston Globe about grade inflation at Harvard, that he was probably going to get an A minus thing. And what was your reaction, not to this, the email thing, what was your reaction to the story a while, not so long ago in the Globe about Harvard and what is it, A is the average grade and A minus is the mean or some, what was your reaction to that?
To the grade inflation story. It's part of the everybody gets a trophy society we live in where, you know, you come in sixth place and in the Braintree Little League, and you're up there front and center on stage, everybody telling you did great. But the Ivies at Harvard hasn't always been like that. I mean, once you get in there, aren't you just considered anointed for life? So you kind of roll your eyes at it. And I didn't go to Harvard. There wasn't a chance in hell I would have gotten into Harvard. So you just kind of roll your eyes and say that's for other people.
And look how well you did, Brian, despite that handicap going into the journalism business. Hey, what about Shaughnessy's piece on the front page of the Globe today? This is a great story. For people who haven't read it, he talks about the fact that some people expect a sports writer at the Boston Globe to be rooting for the hometown teams. And he's saying he's here to write, not to root. But you do see other people, other sports writers, who do seem to be rooting.
You do. I mean, and that's Dan's point here. I thought it was a really effective column. Dan is one of the great voices in sports in this town and maybe in the country, and takes a lot of flack because he is very much a realist. And when everybody wants to see the good, Dan is looking at it, in a very straight way, and he sees problems where others, don't want to see that. And he wrote a very thoughtful, very provocative column today that we put on the front page about why it is that a sports writer doesn't so much care who wins, what they care about is that it's a good story, and that he knows bothers a lot of people in the age of the internet, when you can go into when you can go online and just speak to each other, and there's an amen choir, and you know, they don't want to hear Dan point out problems where they just want to see greatness.
Okay, let's move on to something we talked about last week, or move backwards to something we talked about last week. We talked a little bit about tipping. Let's hear the sound from our conversation about this, please, Brian McGroy, editor of the Boston Globe.
Brian, I assume you're doing a misdirection play because you do not tip the sanitation workers.
We do. I do, actually.
Yeah.
I do.
How much do you give them, and how do you do it?
I you know.
We're just wondering, Brian, it's a week from Christmas. Have you checked, have you resolved this issue with the sanitation workers?
Do you want to know the truth? Or
no,
do you want...
I prefer you not tell us the truth, actually, because we're really short on time.
How about the whole truth, Jim? Do you want the whole truth?
Yes.
Do not want the whole truth. Marjorie may, but I do not.
That appeared, that was last Wednesday.
Yes, it was.
Right.
On Thursday, early morning, I'm out in the yard throwing the ball with the dogs, and it's trash day in my neighborhood, and the truck pulls down the street. And I have Jim's voice in my ear saying, did you tip the sanitation worker? So I go down to the end of the driveway and give the very, very nice sanitation worker, who type of guy, when a scrap of paper comes out of the trash can, he will run it down and pick it up so it doesn't litter. I hand him 20.
Wow.
And
we're
really
short on time, so speed this up.
Back,
hey, Brian, please.
I go back in the house proudly to proclaim that I tipped the guy 20. And I am given endless havoc that I didn't give him more. I thought 20 was a lot.
I thought 20's fine.
I called Jim on the way to work.
Okay, thanks,
I'm
Brian.
I'm curious about what he tips, how much. And I'm dead serious. And I say, so seriously, do you think 20's enough? How much do you tip? Dead silence. Dead silence. No, Jim, how much do you tip? Do we have a bad connection? Total silence. He has never tipped anybody.
No, Brian, I didn't. Brian, excuse me.
You're right, Brian.
Brian.
You're an astute judge of human nature.
If I were to ask you who you voted for governor, you would not tell me. Is that correct? Well, it's a private decision between me and my sanitation worker.
Yeah.
And I chose not to share with
Jim
you.
Jim would
on
have us
own.
Believe that he chases him down the street
on.
In Cambridge, and none of us believe it, including Brian McGroy. Thank you very much.
That $20 would normally get me through 2 weeks, and now I am walking around a lot lighter because of Jim Browdy.
Brian, one last thing, since we're telling tales out of school, I will tell. Marjorie and I are discussing you this morning up in the newsroom. And we decided that since you are probably, and this may be a bit hyperbolic, but I don't think so, probably the only author in the United States of America who is not hawking his own book around Christmas, we're going to hang up on you and thank you, and we're going to hawk your book for you. Is that a deal?
I don't know what you're going to do, Jim.
Goodbye.
But,
thank you. We're not going to talk to you next Wednesday. Merry Christmas,
Brian. Yeah, Merry Christmas, Brian.
Jim, Marjorie, Merry Christmas. Happy holidays. And we will talk early next year.
Yes, we will.
All right.
That's Brian
Thank
McGroy.
You.
Speaking of Brian McGroy, both of us feel the same way. He wrote a great
book called
Buddy, How a Rooster Made Me a Family Man.
It's
sort of a
this?
Memoir.
Why don't you want him to hear this?
What?
You didn't want him to hear this?
No, I didn't care if he heard it or not. Okay. He is totally uncomfortable promoting his own work.
It's terrific.
So I figure we both love the book. And it's a great, great
present.
Well, it's
upbeat, fun, romantic, animals, dogs, girlfriends.
Well, there's sadness,
true love.
I mean, there's sadness, too, around his, obviously, his dog.
His
which
dog.
Is how he meets somebody in the book. In any case, get the book, Buddy, How a Rooster Made Me a Family Man.
Okay, that was Boston Globe editor Brian McGroy, whose book is terrific. And he's with us every Wednesday. Up next, we're going to have a conversation, as we do every Wednesday. Well, actually, every Friday. But today, she's here Wednesday, because Governor Patrick is here Friday. Emily Rooney joins us with her world-famous Emily's List of Observation and Complaints. That conversation next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She's Marjorie Egan. Governor Patrick has the power to veto many things, but it turns out not when it comes to Emily's List. The governor is going to be on our show this Friday, which would have prevented Emily Rooney from being on open mic and from reading her list.
That's right.
But we found a loophole, Marjorie and I. It turns out she can join us today for an early edition. Emily, nice to see you.
I had to really do a quick ramp up, so, you know.
Yeah.
You'll forgive me if
you're
I'm
the woman
my
for
foolish.
The job.
There's nothing like Emily's List, you know, all week long. It's unique. It's my favorite.
I told you guys I sat in a restaurant last Friday night. The guy six. He goes, "Oh, you're Emily Rooney." He starts ticking off my list from that day. That's great.
That was great. But before we get to your world famous list, Emily, you have an issue with this kid from Harvard.
Yes.
That's in trouble for claiming there were bombs at the school. This 20-year-old Eldo Kim. What's your issue with Mr.
Eldo?
Kim?
What kind of a name is that? Anyway, my issue is that this seems to be a much more serious infraction than what those two kids at the University of Massachusetts Dartmouth did in helping out Jahar Tsarnaev. I mean, that was really, really stupid, too. But they're in jail. They've been in jail since April.
Hell without bail.
Yeah. This kid disrupted an entire college campus, sent, you know, hundreds of people into a frenzy, you know, had state, local police, who knows, the FBI, whatever, you know, and this was a so-called prank. This kid should be in jail.
Well,
by the way,
he's going to be in federal court today, so the feds take these things very seriously.
They do take it seriously.
For those who don't recall, can I just for 1 second, the two people that Emily's talking about, whose name I can't pronounce, neither is being charged with having any prior knowledge of the plot or assisting in the bombing. They're saying these are the people that attempted to obstruct justice and get rid of the stuff
computer.
And that sort of thing.
It was really
they
stupid.
They took his backpack with and it had the computer
and threw
inside
it away.
Threw it in the trash, and it wound up in a landfill down near UMass Dartmouth.
That was really dumb.
I frankly think it's outrageous that they're incarcerated for all this time. I get that part of it could be because they're not Americans and their families are overseas. And
so take away the passports.
Bail has to do with flight risk.
Is this Eldo kid American?
I don't know if he is or not.
But that could be prosecutors. One of their main arguments is that he's a flight risk. Suppose that they go back to Russia. We can't get them out. But again, in that case, you could make the bail really high.
I mean, I'm sure this guy will get thrown out of Harvard. I mean, he's going to pay the price. There's no question about that. But this is a serious offense.
I agree with you.
Although, you know, I've got to say, when I heard this, having been in a panic about not being able to graduate from college myself when my family's flying out to California for the graduation ceremony, I mean, not that I was ever going to do it, but you thought about ways of getting out of exams. Yeah. You thought about ways to, you know, I did anyway.
Well,
didn't you?
There are a lot of things
of course,
we think about.
But you don't carry
but
you
don't
through
do
them.
Them. And
no,
by the way,
you
know what's interesting about this comparison, which I don't think you're aware of?
I wanted to have an earthquake. That's what I thought
you
could do.
That the charges against the two friends of the younger Tsarnaev and the charges, at least the current charges against this Eldo Kim, the penalties are exactly the same, up to 5 years in prison and up to a $250,000 fine. The other reality, I think, vis-a-vis this Kim guy at Harvard, beyond what you mentioned, Emily, is unless they are tough with this guy, it's basically an invitation for others to do the same.
I mean, his was an intentional act of disruption, terrorism, in a sense. These other two kids get swept up in the moment Jahar calls them and says, "Hey, make my stuff disappear." They don't really know what the heck is going on. At that point, they probably knew he was associated. I mean,
not with the initial text. Subsequently, they're watching CNN as they say they, quote, freaked out. And again, none of us are defending their behavior, but comparing. And my guess is, you know, the other issue is they're two UMass Dartmouth kids. This guy's a Harvard student. The question is if that will play out in terms of prosecutors dealing with him differently. Specifically, you said the guy's in court today?
Yes, I believe.
Are they going to ask that he be held without bail?
We'll find out.
I doubt it.
I mean, you know, it is the kids of the UMass Dartmouth situation with the marathon bombing. They just they dumped his backpack in the trash.
Yeah.
You know, obviously they shouldn't have done it.
They weren't co-conspirators.
But it was sort of almost a, just drop it. It wasn't like thinking.
No.
And this kid was thinking.
No, but he planned this.
By the way, I agree with everything you're both saying. However, the charges against these two kids are still pretty serious, very serious
really
charges.
Serious.
Because arguably a lot of the evidence that ultimately they're going to present against this Jahar Tsarnaev was stuff that may have been on the laptop or other things that they disposed of. But the issue is comparable treatment or non-comparable. I mean, this came up with the same prosecutor's office with the Aaron Swartz situation with the young guy who ended up killing killing himself because of these charges. There is so, on so many prosecutorial levels, sentencing levels, there is so much imbalance yes. between how people are treated.
Well, you know,
we all sound like Harvey Silverglate here.
Well, but Harvey makes a lot of wonderful points.
And to me, the biggest imbalance is you have people time and time again that are in the municipal court for very violent acts against girlfriends or children or neighbors, violent people, scary people with knives and guns yep. and stuff. They have to practically kill somebody before they go to jail almost at
exactly.
all. I mean, you're assault and battery over and over and over and over again. That's the difference between the federal courts, which are
right.
very, very serious, and the state and district courts and municipal courts, which is kind of like, oh, well, here's another batterer.
Yeah,
you
just
know,
let him go.
Let him go. Exactly.
Yeah, you know, we're not discussing light things, at least so far, with Emily. Second thing we wanted to talk to you about is people followed this story of this Fitchburg home where this little boy, 5 years old, has been not seen nor heard from in 3 months. Apparently, the people from, was it Division of Children's Services?
Yeah.
Is that what it's called these days?
Department of Children and Families.
DCF. Didn't make the visits they were required. Both the social worker and the supervisor were summarily fired for not having done what they apparently were intended to. By the way, one of the writers on this is Patty Wynn, who may be the busiest reporter in America this week. What's your take on this story?
I think mine is maybe slightly different than Marjorie's. First of all, I'm always just astounded by the circumstances that people live in and that these young children, I mean, that woman sounds like she's got an IQ of about 67. She's unfit to be a mother. She's got huge psychological problems. This guy is 22 years old. They both look like they're in their mid-40s.
The guy, the boyfriend,
yeah.
who apparently is abused and potentially worse.
Cut off the finger of one of the children and... You know, just the circumstances that people live under is astounding. I mean, meanwhile, this mother had created some kind of a ruse or whatever. She said that the boy had moved to Florida to be with the grandmother. So I'm not that tough on the social workers in this case. I have no idea what their caseloads are like. The union claims that they're overburdened. I have no idea. But I can't even imagine trying to get behind what goes on in some of these. It's unbelievable. You wouldn't believe that people treat their children that way.
And by the way, before Marjorie responds, and you've written through the years
tons of stories about social services.
Brandy, the only way the authorities found out about this was when the older daughter, who I think was seven, said to somebody at school that her brother has
hadn't
not
seen her
been
brother,
seen,
and then
started talking about abuse.
How much abuse she had taken, and her other brother, and then the mother.
Well, you know, a woman I knew over the years that worked for DSS, what we used to call it, Department of Social Services, said, you know, there's only two things we do wrong at DSS. We take the children out of their homes, or we don't take the children out of their homes because the problems are so hysterical they're so overwhelming. And the other thing, it's almost always these slippery, creepy boyfriends.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's almost a disaster every time you get this boyfriend coming in with a woman and her small children. And you want to say to these mothers, but they're in no position to do anything else. Keep away from these guys. Just keep away from these guys. But they can't. It's a poverty issue.
So is the summary dismissal of these two, is it a CYA thing? Or did they do, in your estimation, short period of time, could they have done a decent...
I'll give my last speech about the Department of Social Services. I said this to Jim before he came down this morning. We just had the city council in Boston, and it's city money as opposed to state money, approve a 25% raise for police officers who are already making $109,000 in Boston. We pay social workers next to nothing. We pay foster care parents next to nothing. There's a get what you pay for thing here. And there's also the fact that we don't really care about these kids because for as long as I've been a reporter, which is 30 years, I've written story after story about atrocities. It never changes because the agency gets no money. The foster parents get no money. It's not very sexy. You can't make your political chops defending children up at the state house. Nobody wants to hear about it. And so, you know, in some sense, it's our own fault because we don't take the issues of poverty and children seriously.
It's inevitability.
Yeah. Can I say one thing about foster families? I know you know much more about it than I, Marjorie, but a couple of years ago, by chance, I was at the State House for the annual luncheon. Some of them great. The argument always, you said they don't get much money. The argument always is from angry members of the public, the only reason they do this is to get money from the state. I sat down and then subsequently interviewed a couple, and I can't remember their names. They're quite well known, who've had hundreds of foster kids come through their family, virtually all of whom stay in touch with them as adults. Virtually all of them come home through. And when they – I don't remember the numbers. When they told me how much money they get to do, they'd lose money on this proposition. It is because they love kids and they want to take care of them.
It was $17 a day. It may have gone up. 40 something. But, I mean, can you imagine being a foster parent? You bring in a little girl like that 7-year-old. I mean, the psychological damage, the way she's used to eating, getting dressed. I mean, she has no
And being scared
sense.
All the time in this case.
She's going to get her head bashed in.
Which apparently, at least according to her, has happened on the part of this
boyfriend. Yeah, I've often wondered if we'd be better off with what we used to have a million years ago, which is kids at least being together.
Orphanages.
To go to orphanages.
Did you write that years ago?
I think I've written it before.
Was that pre-comment? Was that pre-comment on stories? Because I can imagine what kind of that was pre.
Well, not that orphanages are any day at the beach, but one of the terrible things about foster care is very often the siblings are separated. Yeah. Now they try to put more siblings together in foster care, but they can't always do it. There are
like
a lot.
You wonder in this case if those two are together.
Yeah,
or not. Probably
there
not.
Are a lot of saints. By the way, you're right about that. There are a lot of saints that work in this business. They're foster care parents who do wonderful things. But I just.
The answer is forced sterilization.
That was Emily Rooney. No, that's whenever something like that happens, it was Emily Rooney, Greater Boston, every single night, 7 o'clock. Hey, before we move to your infamous list, American Airlines has settled with a financial firm, many of whose workers were killed on 9/11. What's the deal with that? I just heard about it from
Canada Fitzgerald. So 687 of the 1,000 employees in New York City were killed on September 11th. That is staggering, two-thirds. So the company claims that they faced a dramatic interruption of their business, which I'm sure is true. So they sued American Airlines for interruption of business for to the tune of $1 billion. And so American Airlines settles it this week and for 135, which is a fraction of the billion. But the company gets the money, not the employees or the victims, or because they already got their money through that Ken Feinberg fund.
Well, and additional monies, too, but through the fund,
It seems like a raw deal to me. So the lawsuit was—
Raw deal
was
for whom? The
for
victims
American Airlines.
Or for why?
Because the lawsuit said that American Airlines should have done what the United States government could not do, which was stop these terrorists from getting on the airplane. It's like, you know— Are you a terrorist?
Yeah, but kind of, Emily, this is one of my favorite topics because, well, I have no sympathy for the airlines. Are you aware when Tom Daschle's wife, who was a lobbyist for the airlines, he's a former Democratic Senate leader, lobbied for a bill that ultimately became the Victims Compensation Fund? You're aware that nobody was concerned about victims' compensation at first, even though they trumpeted it for the 3,000 families. It was all about providing immunity to the airlines from litigation. That was the quid pro quo. We will give billions of dollars.
Put the airlines out of business.
Well, whatever it was. I mean, but whatever it was. But the reality was that was the
the
motivation there. I don't know enough to blame the airlines. Yeah, but if it
can't.
Here's my assumption. If the airlines thought at the end of a trial that they weren't going to be found liable, I'm not in love with Cantor Fitzgerald as a firm either. But having said that, if it turns out they thought they weren't going to lose this thing, American Airlines wouldn't have paid them $135 million. Is that not a fair statement?
Well, I'm sure they settled. It took 12 years, and they settled for a fraction of it. I think nobody wanted to go to court. A court case could have lasted years.
Maybe so. Now, on a much more important note, Emily, a couple of Fridays ago, do you remember when you heard a couple of Fridays ago? You made this observation when you were on a recent airplane trip. Listen to this, please.
People actually read the Federal Register.
No, they don't.
The guy next to me in first class had the Federal Register. It was 5 inches thick. He had like 15 bookmarks. He was flipping furiously back and forth, page 81, page 881, back, forth, back, forth. I was fascinated.
Okay, that was Emily Rooney a couple of weeks ago. When Bill Moyers, you heard of him, Emily?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, when Bill Moyers was interviewing Mark Leibovich, a local guy who's obviously gone national, about his new book on D.C. culture, here's Moyers quoting from Leibovich's book about why Wall Street hires lobbyists and why they read the Federal Register. Listen up.
They have figured out that despite the exorbitant cost of hiring lobbyists, the ability to shape or tweak or kill even the tiniest legislative loophole can be worth tens of millions of dollars.
So you're not the only one who goes out and finds answers to questions, like driving down the highway to investigate a bear. That's why they do it. They're looking for little tiny loopholes.
She was sitting next to a lobbyist, is what you're saying?
Apparently you
maybe
were.
Maybe it was.
That's what they are, and they're looking for any way.
By the way, I have to explain why I was in first class because I freaked out about getting to Washington, D.C. for Thanksgiving, and I bought that exorbitant ticket.
Oh, remember that, How much was that you were going to tell me? You told me off the air.
You'd be aghast.
So that was the bottom line. We wanted to solve the problem because you're always problem solved. Now, here's what you came here for.
incomprehensible.
It's out of control.
How about common sense?
Doesn't matter.
Why not?
This is the kind of thing that drives people crazy.
It's your right.
Doesn't matter. I have absolutely no interest.
Doesn't matter. Okay. What is it? I am told there's a theme to this week.
Well,
is that correct?
Yes, it's weather and
Perfect.
Holiday related.
Oh,
fabulous.
Good.
That's
all right.
Great.
So,
go ahead.
I don't know about you guys, but come the end of summer and fall, I start really, really dreading the onslaught of winter.
Me
and
too.
Hold
Me too.
And start thinking of stepping out at night when it's really, really cold and you have to go to the grocery store or whatever it is. And then what happens is, like last night, it's not so bad. It was almost like kind of cool. It was like fun. It was like beautiful.
Took me 94 minutes to drive from Boston Common to Central Square in Cambridge.
It was fun.
Next.
It was a challenge.
Oh, that was fun. What and was then, the fun? Excuse me. No, no, no.
It
what
was
the
very
fun
pretty.
Part of that? What was the fun
well,
the, part?
Well, I started walking around the city
and
afterwards.
And the decorations and the yeah. Christmas trees
was,
and the it, lights on
was,
the buildings.
Kind
the back
of fun.
Bay looks beautiful at this time of year.
All right. So here's,
drive around and enjoy
I made this
it.
Observation last year okay, during right. that big snowstorm in February, but yeah. it really was solidified for me last night. Taxi cabs. Are the problem. So, you know, the light turns, and you can see it's about to turn because they have the countdown, 10, 9, 8. They pull into the intersection, and then the cross street people cannot move. Everybody else is behaving except the taxi cabs.
On my honor, I began to tweet that very same point
really?
In my 94 minutes, and my younger daughter was with me, who goes nuts
really?
When I use my phone. I said, I hope I can say this
He's
on this.
Tweeting while
I
driving.
I would say, who are the biggest a-holes
yes.
on the planet is what I tweet. That's
cab
what's
drivers.
It called in New York City about block? Something
yeah.
to block. Blocking the
yeah.
something.
Intersection.
There's, you know, they have in New York
I
City,
know.
In intersections. No, well, there's another word
there
for it.
There's a word for
They're
it.
They're all markings. They have white X's or
yep.
something. And if you end up running the light and getting stuck in the middle and blocking traffic
yep.
in the other direction,
yep.
you get some huge ticket.
They
and
shoot
so they
you.
Should.
All right, it's all the cabs.
I am so – well, it's not – by the way, cabs are part of the problem, but also these drivers that have no respect for anybody
I
else.
Cabs have snow most, tires yet. I mean, why are the cabs always fishing?
They don't have snow tires.
Yeah.
You don't know that they don't have snow tires. How do you know
that? Fish tailing.
She's right.
Okay, fine.
Although on my list of things today is I'm giving my own car a 3 out of 10.
Why?
So I was so excited. I went out and bought wheels and tires. If I have a sports car, I thought, oh, I'm going to be solid. You know, and it was a lot of money for a package. You get the big snow tires and the wheels, which are really cool looking. I used to have a Subaru, and that was just like get out of my way. I could blow anybody off the roads in the snow, but this thing,
terrible.
Sad.
I'm very
That's
sad.
That's too
about
bad.
That.
You want to
Jim
hear
and
about
I have
my
4-wheel drive?
And I had a car. My car detailed.
Mine's a
Boston Common the other day, right for the snowstorm. It's never. It looks like brand new. It's
oh, really?
Beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
All right.
It's covered in
here's
snow.
Another,
yeah, what's another?
Here's
one?
Another complaint. So people this morning are parking at the meters, but they're 6 feet into the road. I don't understand that. Why would anyone park? First of all, I would never leave my car in a situation like that. I mean, for any 6 feet, and I'm
you're
sure
on
they didn't,
fire, Emily.
Yeah.
Except for that first misguided thing about
oh,
how great it.
It
was last
all
night.
Right.
You
it
are so
lovely.
Right on. Go ahead. Why would you do that? By the way, I even don't do that.
Do what?
If there's snow,
no.
if there are mounds of snow and they force you to only be able to get 4 to 6 feet away from a meter, then you don't park there.
Well,
she's right.
With my 4-wheel drive, I barrel right into the snowbank.
No,
well,
but I mean, you got to give the plows a chance to get it out of there.
Oh, I'm you mean when
so
the
it's
plows
just stupid.
Are coming.
Okay.
5 years, $250,000 fine. That's my position.
Go
ahead, Emily.
All right. So these are party season related. So
go ahead.
Have you ever had this feeling come over you like you're really looking forward to somebody's party or event and it's just so excited as oh, it's such a good time every year. I can't wait to go. And then the day comes and you thought, I'm not going.
Happens to me all the time.
Why is that? What is that? Jim's nodding. It's like, what is that?
Do you want me to tell her what I do, which is one of the most, the best. This is a variation on your theme. Anytime I'm invited to something that I am convinced I'm really not going to want to do when the time comes,
yep.
I don't just say no. I write down in my book the time period that I would have spent doing the thing that I really didn't want to do so that when the moment comes and I'm not doing it,
yeah.
it reinforces how
wow.
good my decision was.
Isn't that funny?
Isn't that brilliant?
Everybody
so even if it's months in advance,
I start
do
doing that.
It's fabulous.
All right.
My pleasure.
Other,
thank you.
It's a lot of trouble if you're a woman, too. You
I'm almost done.
On
no,
I
don't keep going. You can
all
go
right,
all day.
So
if
I saw
you
the best ad
good.
I've ever seen in my life in the New York Times today. It says, Parlez-vous Target.
It's pretty good.
making fun of themselves because everybody calls it Tarjay.
Tarjay.
It's the cutest thing I've ever seen.
I love Tarjay. I was there for an hour yesterday.
Parlez-vous Tarjay?
Okay, wait, before you go ahead, let's have a contest between you and me, Marjorie. Uh-huh. What are the odds? Don't answer this, Emily. That Emily has ever been to Target. What would you say? I would say zero. What would you say?
No, I can see Emily over there buying her paper towels and Charmin toilet
What's
paper
the answer?
And stuff like
zero.
That.
This,
of course. I mean, what are you talking about? Emily Rooney and Tarjay?
It's great.
Okay, move along. Go ahead. I knew
right.
that. I
so
read that
my
one.
Clothes come
This is
from
something
Tarjay.
I promised. So the favorite gift I bought, and is Will here today?
No, he is
so
not
my,
yet.
So my sister, like Will, used to play the cello. Mm-hmm. And actually, she
She's
was pretty good at it.
She's a cello player.
I found this really cool. She's not listening, so I can tell her. I found this really cool thing at 450 Harrison Avenue, which is the arts studios and stuff. Have you ever seen that guy who makes stuff out of wire hangers? It's the most cool art. So this is a female cellist, and it's you know done as a couple pieces of wire, and the bow actually moves. So you hit the bow,
oh,
and
that
it
is
just
great.
Like, and it's and you hang great. It up with one little thing, and it's gonna look. And she's got a picture of herself playing the cello, actually a little painting. She could put that right next to it. I'm so excited about it. And it was not not expensive.
Avenue?
They have everything. You know, dogs, cats, golfers. They make these little figures.
They 450. Do?
It was not expensive. It was the store is just packed with this.
I love places like that. And Newbury Street has got that S-D-E-T-S-Y, that thing that's online that has all the homemade, one-of-a-kind crafts. They've opened a store for Christmas on Newbury Street, which is supposed to be great, too.
And one other piece of advice, since that sounds so great, if you want comparable things at a slightly reduced price, Tarjay has all these originals. Emily, we're not going to see you before Christmas.
No, I'm not.
So
but I have to tell you what I want for Christmas.
Oh, yes. What is
I have
sure.
one more thing here.
Okay.
I don't have a wine opener that works. I'm just saying. Okay? That's all.
Okay.
I
know. I don't have
things?
It.
You don't
no,
have one?
I don't
God,
have
they
it.
Cost about $3.
Okay.
Got to
get it.
I'll spring for that.
Wine opener that works. We got it. Okay. Emily, it's been a pleasure.
Emily Rooney,
all right. Have a good
Merry
Christmas.
Christmas.
See you later. Wine opener that works.
Looking forward to 52 weeks of lists in the year 2014. See you later. Emily Rooney joins us every week for Open Mic. You can also see her every night on Greater Boston at 7 o'clock. And on Friday nights, Greater Boston does Beat the Press. That, of course, is Channel 2. When we come back, the Reverend Tim Skank, one of the forces behind the popular devotional Lenten Madness. He joins us to talk about his new book, which promises to help us get through the chaos of Advent and Christmas. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We first invited Reverend Tim Skank on our show last spring to talk about his popular devotional, Lenten Madness. Now he's given us another excuse to have him here. His new book, title is Dog in the Manger, Finding God in Christmas Chaos. He's rector of the Episcopal Parish of St. John the Evangelist in Hingham. Reverend Skank, it's so good to see you again.
Great to be back. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. Now, it is a provocative title, Dog in the Manger. What's the book about, and how are we supposed to find God in the chaos at the mall?
Well, let me talk about the title, first of all. Do you know the expression, Dog in the Manger?
No.
Never heard that?
Nor do I.
It's something my mother used to say, and it turns out it's actually from one of Aesop's fables. So there's this dog who goes into a manger, and he's lying down on the hay. He falls asleep, and then a hungry ox walks in and is kind of like, dog, can you move because I'm hungry? And the dog refuses. And so a dog in the manger is someone who selfishly keeps something to himself even if he can't use it. Now, the reason that I use this—
By the way, I've been barking for weeks along those lines, so I guess— But go right ahead. I'm sorry.
You're the big dog in the manger, Jim.
Yes,
yes, thank you. Well, and my dog is named Delilah, by the way. You know, I did claim naming rights because the kids wanted Chippy or something like that at one point. So, and who was going to be yelling out the dog's name in the neighborhood? That would have been me. So, anyway, we have this nativity scene at the house. And when the kids were younger, they're 14 and almost 13 now, but when they were younger, everything, all sorts of characters would show up into this nativity scene. So you'd have, you'd have the usual Jesus and Joseph and the angels and Mary and all that. And then you would have Darth Vader. You'd have the Red Power Ranger. You'd have all sorts of characters would show up. And I think, you know, great. I think everybody is welcome at the manger, so that's perfect. The only heresy would have, potential heresy would have been if Darth Vader started saying, "Jesus, I am your father." but that was okay. But anyway, so at one point, Delilah, she'd come over because she'd be interested, and she'd jam her snout into the nativity scene as well. So I thought, oh my God, literally, we have a dog in the manger. So that became the title.
What kind of dog is Delilah, please?
She is a – thank you for asking about Delilah, by the way. She is a yellow lab and husky mix. She's great. Ooh. She comes to the office with me just about every day.
Oh, great.
Now, Tim, you one of the things I read – I didn't read the whole thing, I must say, even though it's a fairly short – well, I just got it this morning. I've read dribs and drabs here and there. At one point you use, which I assume most of us, was gift wrapping as a metaphor for faith.
Yes.
Around Christmas. Could you explain the gift wrapping faith connection?
I can. And in fact...
Oh, that's what you opened it
to?
Yeah. Perfect.
I just happened to open this. So
he's going to read a little excerpt from his book, Dog in the Manger.
Yeah. Do you want me to use my Montgomery Burns voice?
I was going to ask
you.
Sure.
No, okay. I'll just read it.
That's pretty good.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Been working on it. A good metaphor for faith around the holidays may be found in the way I wrap Christmas presents. Unlike my wife, Brenna, who wraps gifts as if she works in a Hallmark store, which she did while in high school, I'm the worst wrapper this side of the North Pole. It's embarrassing. Tape and paper everywhere, ends and corners sticking out, and a ribbon two sizes too big. There's a gift in there somewhere. It just takes a while to find. This past Christmas, I gave up and wrapped Brenna's present in plastic grocery store bags. Little did the cashier know when she asked if I preferred paper or plastic that she was serving as my own personal elf. Our faith is a gift, but it isn't a perfectly wrapped present with exact folds and a precisely tied bow. It's more like the way I wrap. Fortunately, faith isn't about being neat and tidy. You may burn the Christmas roast. Santa may not bring your child exactly what she wanted. You might even get sick and miss out on the best party of the year. But through it all, God remains.
So, it's quite something.
Very nice.
A very nice reading also. So are people in your line of work upset when it is clear that Christmas has become a much more secular kind of thing, even for people of religion? I'm not saying, by the way, there obviously is a piece of the population that takes the religious part of it very seriously, but it's a time of family, relaxation, shopping. Does that upset you?
Well, I refer to it as the Christmas industrial complex, and it is alive and well and thriving. And I you always have to balance the practical with the spiritual. And so I think if you're trying to balance those things, you're going to be okay.
But you know what happens, and it happens to me every year, even though I'm always going to start back in July Christmas shopping, and I never, of course, do. What you find is you are so frenzied toward the end that things you might like to attend. We had the Blue Heron Choir piece
Brian
of
McCreath
that.
Is
Brian McCreath was playing, and I thought.
Who Father Tim knows quite well, by the way.
Yes,
so
I do. Went to seminary with his wife, Amy.
That's right.
An Episcopal priest in Watertown.
Well, anyway, I thought I would love to go hear them Friday or Saturday night. They're at the first church in Cambridge. But, I mean, forget it because I'm so far behind in my shopping. You find, like, a lot of these things that you just would like to do that would be a sort of a spiritual thing get shunted aside because you're going again to the mall.
Right.
And I think that it
she
does
wants
get,
help, Father. That's what
well,
she's
does
basically
get, I think
saying.
I'm not
Can
the only person that finds themselves – I mean, there are other disorganized last-minute procrastinators in the world besides me.
Yeah, I used to love – doing all my Christmas shopping on Christmas Eve. When I was in my early 20s, that was just great sport.
I
didn't actually get anything thoughtful or meaningful for anyone in my life, but I love that. Now, unfortunately, my parishioners, they're funny. They expect me to work on Christmas Eve and Christmas Day, so I can't really do that. So I need to be a little bit more intentional. I'm still not very good at shopping, but you're absolutely right. We have to make choices and priorities, and you try to balance it. You take, for instance, have you heard of this Elf on the Shelf?
Of course, yeah.
So everybody loves Elf on the Shelf. My boys were too old for that, so we missed it. But you know, so a lot of people have fun. They put the elf into funny poses, some inappropriate poses if you really Google it. But
explain, by the way, for what Elf on the Shelf is.
Elf on the Shelf is. It's literally this little elf, and it, you, I guess you can stick it on a shelf. You can put it in different poses, and it moves around every night. And so parents will move this elf around, and the idea is that the elf is watching. So be on your best behavior, because nothing says ho, ho, ho like threats. But so I thought, okay, we have elf on the shelf. So what would the religious equivalent of this be? So I have this little figurine of Jesus. And so this December, Advent in the Christian year, the 4 weeks leading up to Christmas, I started going around and taking pictures of my little Jesus figure on top of Ford cars and trucks. I call it Lord on the Ford. And
well, you just walk around looking for Ford cars and trucks,
yeah,
and you plop the Jesus
everyone,
on top?
Yeah, I mean, it's not like I do this all day, but I've done this a couple times, and then I post them on Facebook or Twitter, and it's pretty fun. But it's that reminder that Jesus is in the midst of this. And I'm trying to get the Ford Motor Company to give me a bright red Mustang for Christmas. I haven't seen it in the driveway. And if they don't come through, I may have to switch to Jesus on the Prius. I don't know.
That's right. Jesus is supposed to be environmentally conscious, is he not?
Absolutely.
You know, how come you have not said like 18 times who your illustrator is, which is a really a generous and decent thing for a writer like you to do? Why have you not done that, Father?
Jeez.
Who is it?
I have this little book, Dog in the Manger, is if you don't pick it up for the writing, pick it up for the illustrations.
He's really good.
They're terrific.
Very
really
good.
He's actually a priest and a cartoonist named Jay Side.
What's his name again?
Jay Sidebotham. And one of the best things about Jay is before he went to seminary, he was one of the artists that was involved with Schoolhouse Rock.
Mm.
So Conjunction Junction, What's Your Function, all that great stuff if you're of a certain age. You remember all that. So the cartoons really are terrific.
Who's the audience for this thing? Who's your desired demographic?
You mean besides everybody?
No, I mean, is it everybody?
Well, it really is. I think in a lot of ways, parents can really relate to it, parents of young children. But also, it's really for anyone who is just trying to find some sense of spirituality in the midst of the craziness of Christmas.
You know, there are some great cartoons in this. The one where the angel is coming to inform Mary that she's going to be the mother of Jesus. There's little Mary sitting on her stool with, "Why me?" as the angel flies in. It's pretty great. And I like the Holy Hangover and the post-Christmas blues with the sad-looking little tree sitting there with just one little bulb or a couple little bulbs hanging.
Can you get this thing anywhere, by the way? Is this
available? You can get this pretty much anywhere. It's available on Nook and Kindle and all that kind of thing. You can get it on Amazon, although I suggest that people go right to the publisher, Forward Movement, and forwardmovement.org is the website. And if you happen to be in Hingham, you can pick it up at Glastonbury Abbey's bookstore or Red Eye Roasters. That's where I do all my writing, the coffee shop.
Perfect.
Art says elves on the shelf are manufactured in China under contract to the NSA, and they really are watching us all the time.
You know, speaking of, what's the name of that roasting deal?
Red Eye Roasters.
Okay, enough of this finding God in Christmas.
Yes, you can find God in coffee. Christmas I do every day.
You write quotes about coffee and Christianity. And
they're great.
You don't just write about it. You write about it nonstop, obsessively. First of all, I am coffee obsessed. Marjorie's pretty close behind. What's the coffee deal with you, and particularly the religious connection?
Well, the deal is that it's a life source. What else do you want? I admit that I'm a coffee snob, and I do. I write all of my sermons. Anything that I write, I think it's a Pavlovian thing at this point. I can't do it unless I have a cup of good black coffee.
Black.
With me. Oh, yeah.
No sugar?
No.
Now,
really?
Good means not only no Dunkin' Donuts, which you disparage,
no,
but no Starbucks, which you also disparage.
Correct.
Is that correct?
So
that
what
is
kind
correct
of coffee, do tell?
Well, it's got to be freshly roasted, of course. So when I go to a couple coffee shops where I tend to hang out, they do all their roasting right there on site. And Red Eye and Hingham does. It's a pretty new shop, but it's just great. So it's the smell, it's the ambiance. It's everything.
Have you ever said to yourself, Father Tim, should I kill myself or have a cup of coffee, like Albert Camus allegedly said. Have you ever said that?
Yeah, pretty much every morning, yes.
Yeah. By the way, are these quotes real?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think you're reading some stuff from my blog, Clergy, Family,
yes.
Confidential.
Read
yeah.
the one from Johann Sebastian Bach.
Why don't you read it?
One.
Go right ahead.
Okay. I didn't even know coffee was around in Bach's day.
This is a good one, too.
Without my morning coffee, I'm just like a dried up piece of roast goat.
Yes. Couldn't have said it any better.
I love that.
Myself.
It's absolutely fantastic. And the person that did the substituted caffeine for the 23rd Psalm is pretty impressive, too.
Why don't you read that, Father, since your earlier
great.
Reading
okay.
was excellent.
It's absolutely
this
great.
This is by an anonymous.
Anonymous. Anonymous
correct?
Is very talented.
Okay, I will try to do it in my priestly voice.
Go ahead.
Is this your priestly voice, by the way?
I don't have a... You know, there are some clergy that have these stained glass voices.
Yeah, you don't have that thing
no,
going,
I don't,
no.
I don't. I can't stand that.
Okay,
all right, here we go. Caffeine is my shepherd. I shall not doze. It maketh me to wake in green pastures. It leadeth me beyond the sleeping masses. It restoreth my buzz. It leadeth me in the paths of consciousness for its name's sake.
Marjorie and I are laughing like fools, by
yay.
The way, at this thing. God, excuse me. I'm sorry, Father.
Excuse
Tim.
Me. You're
sorry.
Interrupting this psalm.
I'm sorry.
Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of addiction, I will fear no equal. For thou art with me. Thy cream and thy sugar, they comfort me. Thou preparest a carafe before me in the presence of the Starbucks. Thou anointest my day with pep. My mug runneth over.
Read the equal line again, because Marjorie had explained that to me. What's the line
capital,
that ends with equal?
Capital E.
I will fear no equal.
And that point being, for those who are uninitiated, like equal as in
hold
the sugar
he
substance.
Finished. Exactly. He
oh,
finished.
Someone finished?
Yeah, you don't even
sorry,
know.
Sorry, Father Tim.
That's it, right? Oh, no.
The
I'm,
end of
okay.
the
Wait a second.
The end of
wait,
it.
Let's
right.
be clear here. Father Tim did not even know
yes,
it was not
did.
The end. Did
yes,
you know it was
did.
The end of the song, Father Tim?
I don't read my own blog.
Okay, guys.
I just write the thing.
Go ahead. What is it?
All right. Surely richness and taste shall follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of Mocha's forever.
That
is
very
so
good.
Beautiful.
I like that it's put into Elizabethan English.
It's
that
wonderful.
Really brings it out. Brings out the flavor.
And again, the name of the blog is Clergy Family Confidential. I'm sorry.
Here's
Marty.
Another great one from Ronald Reagan. Quote, I never drink coffee at lunch. I find it keeps me awake for the afternoon.
I love the fact that I came in here to talk about my book, and we're all talking about coffee. This is one of my favorite topics.
Well, why don't you say one more thing? If someone said to you, which I'm sure, well, in fact, I'm about to say it to you, explain in 30 seconds or less why this is a must-have for this particular Christmas season. There's 7 days to go in the purchasing period. Explain why Dog in the Manger, Finding God in Christmas Chaos is a must-have, Father Tim.
It's really a must-have because I spend all of my disposable income on coffee. And so I really need people to buy this book and to help them really find keep their December, their Christmas season really anchored in faith and in what really matters. I think it gives this whole season meaning. Otherwise, there's not a whole lot of there.
Father Tim,
thank
you are
very
a good
much.
Soul.
And
you
congratulations
really are a good soul.
On
you.
The wonderful
thank
new
you.
Book, Dog in the Manger, Finding God in Christmas Chaos.
The coffee stains all over the copy.
Yeah,
is,
there
is
are.
The only problem.
Reverend Tim Skank is the rector of the Episcopal Parish of St. John the Evangelist in Hingham. Thanks so much for coming in and visiting us. When we come back, we're going to ask you, continuing our Christmas theme here, where you come down on Christmas lights, white lights or colored lights. The Battle of the Bulbs is next on 89.7 WGBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan. It's a dispute that plays out in the shopping malls, the living rooms, and sometimes outdoors among neighbors. White Christmas lights versus colored ones. Where are you on this? Do you go for the more sophisticated simplicity? That's how they describe it, of white lights. Are you among those who like to go festive, decking things out with the entire color spectrum? It's another one of our quick hits for Christmas at 877-301-8970. And much to the surprise, I think, of our listeners, who is the white light person in this room and who is the colored light person in this room? Marjorie, go ahead.
I am the white light person in this room.
And why is that?
Well, I'm an aspiring snob and kind of wasp kind of person. I want to have a certain sort of sophistication. This piece says people who have white lights are pathological about them. Usually they're the same people who stuff their TV into an armoire and try to pretend they don't have one. Now,
70% of Americans, roughly 70% of lights that are purchased are white lights.
If I had an armoire, yeah, I would stuff my television in there so I could pretend that I didn't have a television in practically every room. I don't know. I just like them. I think they're prettier. They are sort of snobby, I guess. You know, you go down certain places, like down the Cape where my sister lives, the main street in Centerville. It's an historic district.
It's pretty.
And all the houses, white lights. That's it.
Isn't Com Ave white lights on the trees?
White
there?
Lights on Commonwealth Avenue. That's right, halfway up the trees. I wish they put them all the way up the trees. You do see the wild and crazy person occasionally who dares do the colored lights. But white lights, you know, I don't know. They give me a certain je ne sais quoi.
I think there's much more joy in multicolored lights. The mm-hmm. one thing I should say at 877-301-8970, the one light-related topic where I think there is commonality between me and Marjorie, mm-hmm. is it between me and Marjorie or amongst the
between.
Two? Between me
amongst
and Marjorie.
Amongst three.
Sorry. Well, there are only two of us, so it must be between. What is that one light issue on which we are both in total, we're in total agreement?
Well, I like the creamy ones.
No.
The light.
No flashing.
Oh!
Ever.
No flashing.
Ever.
No flashing. We just talked about Target. I was in Target for like an hour yesterday, as I said, and I got to the register and I realized by mistake I bought twinkling lights. I had to go back and look for the non-twinkling.
No, twinkling is not
lights.
Happening. 877.
White lights, white, whatchamacallit, wire.
Thank you. Oh, whoa, very nice. 301-8970. 877-301-8970. Quickly, if you would, give us a buzz. We want to find out, are you a white light person? Are you a colored light person? And much more importantly, we want to know why. Incidentally, this piece in the New York Times tells us some interesting things. People used to use candles, obviously. I hadn't thought about it, but it's pretty obvious. Electric Christmas lights began replacing the fire hazards in the early 1900s. And again, 100-some years later, I was shocked by this. 70% of lights that are purchased, I really find that hard to believe, are of the white variety.
Now, Nanda raised something that I wanted to talk about later, but she raised it, so I'll talk about it right now. She said, not only does it have to be white, it has to be warm white. She tried the LED lights, returned them the next day because they're
too
not...
Too much glare?
No, because the other non-LED are kind of creamy, got a little yellow to them. The LED lights are cold and
so
gray.
So softer, yeah.
The softer lights. I did that too. I have LED lights up, and I'm so upset. That's why I went to Target to get the replace the colored, the warmer lights. I'm very upset about it, Jim.
The only thing that upsets me more than people who just do white lights uh-huh. like you are people who put white lights on a fake tree. That is sort of the perfecta. For me, let's take a couple of calls. Lorna, you're in Auburn. We're talking about white versus colored lights for Christmas on that tree.
Yes,
hi, Lorna.
Yes. And hi, Marjorie.
Hi.
I have a little bit of a different take on this. I don't judge a house by the colors. I judge a house by the way that the lights are put up. How the lights are put up. Are they put up neatly? Are they put up symmetrically? Or some people put up lights and they don't look very pretty, whether they're white or colored.
I think that's a fine point.
But being a teacher, I usually go around every season and I give houses grades on how they put their lights up.
Wait a second. You internally give grades or you actually walk up to the people and say,
I've given you
a B minus for you?
No. I internally give grades. And, I just say to whoever I'm with, that house is probably like a B plus because of this and that. This house is definitely an A+. We just do that. It's kind of a lot of fun.
Yeah,
but you're right.
Lorna, if you could give us, I know it's hard with just words instead of pictures. Describe an A+ house to us under Lorna's grading system.
In my grading system, I don't really have a rubric for grading,
okay.
But it should have a lot of lights. You know, the more lights, the better.
Mm-hmm.
And put up in a very, neat or symmetrical
exactly.
way.
Exactly.
Sometimes you see one little string of lights hanging from a set that's kind of all together, and then you see the string that's hanging on to the plug somewhere, the outlet somewhere.
Lorna, have you ever been to Marjorie's house?
No.
She would probably get a D+. She's got very nice light. No, I'm kidding. She is very meticulous. She looked at me aghast. She does it very carefully and with great care. As I just said. So, Lorna, thank you for the call.
I have to go back out and replace all the LED lights.
Do you have lights in your porch, too, or something?
I do, but because they died. They just, you know, sooner or later they wear out or whatever you call them. So I had to get new ones this year, and I got the LEDs, and big mistake.
Okay, fine. Gifford, you're in Nashua, New Hampshire. We're discussing the great conundrum, white versus colored lights. Hey, Gifford, what's up? Hi.
The way I think of colored lights, it reminds me of like the guy who comes to the party with a Hawaiian shirt on and the shorts with the socks and the sandals. That's colored lights to me. I'm more of a white light person. You know, I think of snow crystals and I think of candle lights, and they all appear white to me.
Exactly.
Yeah. No,
exactly.
You say it well,
now,
Gifford.
Gifford, how do you feel about this? Sometimes I'm tempted. I haven't done it lately, but when I was a kid, we had this big, huge tree, an evergreen tree, like in front of our house, which my father decorated just with blue lights. And I kind of thought that was pretty cool. I've not done it myself, but what do you think about the just plain blue and then white?
You know, blue's not bad because, you know, you think of cold and you think of ice. But when people put the red candles in the window,
that
creeps me out a little bit.
Creepy.
Like
absolutely.
Enemy build kind of.
Yeah.
You're a man with strong opinions, Gifford. Thank you so much for the call. I think the image of the guy coming to the office party in the Hawaiian shirt and the shorts, I mean, I guess I am that person. And I do
like
colored lights.
Always distressing. We have this mutual friend who, of course, I will not name in the air, who has exquisite taste. His home is just exquisite. His wife is a decorator. She is. And next door to them is the most garish, ugly, you know, plastic Santas, and they're dirty, and a million things of strings of lights. It must drive them crazy every single solitary person have to look out the window at this ugly display, and their house is just.
You know what it should be like? You know, when you build a casino, you have to do mitigation for the surrounding communities. When someone does one of those Santa displays, like an inflatable Santa for you,
they're everywhere.
They should make mitigation payments to the neighbors.
Have you noticed they got the inflatable Santas, they got the inflatable reindeers, they got the inflatable Frosty the Snowman? I think those are people with little kids.
I think they are. Let's go to Haverhill, where Peter is on the phone. Peter, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for the call.
Jim and Marjorie, I'm glad you found a home on NPR.
So are we. Thank you for saying it, Peter.
Absolutely.
We love it here.
Hey, several years ago, I lost a secret ballot vote with my wife. Her white lights, my colored lights. I lost the vote 1-1. So having suffered through a year of white lights, and by the way, I don't wear Hawaiian shirts. I came upon a Solomon moment, and I put two sets of lights on, one colored, one white, with two foot pedal switches. When she's home, the white lights are on. When I'm home, the colored lights are on. And our neighbors know who's home. And when we're both home, both sets of lights are on.
Peter, that
My
is
goodness.
A beautiful story. Peter, how did it get to the point where a tie in a secret ballot vote in your household goes to your wife? Where did that come from?
You must understand the secret ballot vote. You must have these votes in your house.
There you go. You make a very fine
You're a good
point.
Husband. You're a good
you
husband,
a good
Peter.
One.
It's a good way to keep the peace because this piece from the New York Times that we were reading before talked about it. This is a big issue with many couples. If they grew up in a house, you know.
It's tradition.
Colored lights, they want colored lights. If they grew up in a house with white, they want white. Now, the marriage therapists, of course, say there are probably bigger issues in the marriage than white versus colored lights. But apparently, for some couples, if they usually have eggnog at Christmas and somebody wants to have champagne instead, you know, all bets are off.
But it is a huge part. I mean, whenever we would have a little tiny Hanukkah bush, which was a compromise on my mother's part, we occasionally did have a little.
Well, you're Jewish.
She was not. Was not very religious, so she had a little Hanukkah bush, which is sort of a quasi Christmas tree. I never thought about this till you just read that. We did have colored lights on the thing, and so it's possible that I am reliving my youth with my adult preference for colored lights.
You don't do the big bulbs. You do the small ones.
No. Let's just resolve that before we leave this.
Because you see those at Target as well.
There is nothing crasser. I'm sorry. Whether you choose white, like Marjorie has done, or colored, as I do, non-twinkling is critical, and the large bulb variety is absolutely inappropriate.
You know,
for the
before we leave
season.
For a second, what is wrong with the twinkling? I mean, it does drive me crazy. Why does it drive you crazy?
Because it's cheap and crass, the whole point of Christmas is supposed to be a soothing
jolt
kind of time. It's sort of like those Japanese lights that cause people to have Why are you looking at me like this?
I don't know about the Japanese lights. It caused you to have what?
They have fit. They can have fits, and I mean I'm not going to go into it.
Oh,
and
okay. Yeah,
seizures is what the word I was looking for. Yes, they do. You've never heard of this?
I never heard of twinkling lights giving
strobe
anybody
lights.
A
Thank
seizure.
Thank you, Chelsea, for filling
strobe
in the blanks.
Lights.
Here they are.
They give you people seizures.
I think we really resolved
that
quite clearly.
It's white lights. That is clearly the result of this conversation.
But we're staying with the Christmas theme yet again.
Yes, we are. We're going to talk with Corby Kummer. He's got the best 2013 cookbook recommendations for all of you last-minute shoppers looking for the best cookbook for the cooks in your life. Stay tuned. 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy, and she would be Margarita. And you can make the case that a cookbook is the perfect present. Here's why. It has great illustrations and photos in most cases. Usually has some history, chemistry, anthropology in the mix. It also, this is the biggest to me, it has the huge benefit of tapping into your do-it-yourself spirit. But unlike most books, you don't feel guilty if you haven't read it yet. So here with us in Studio 3, with his cookbook suggestions for the holiday, is Corby Kummer. I think you know Corby's a senior editor at The Atlantic and an award-winning food writer. Corby, it's great to see you.
Great to be here.
Ooh.
What do you mean, ooh, already?
He just handed me a great one, Cooking for Crowds. Yeah. This is terrific.
Cooking for crabs or for
crowds? Not crabs.
See, let me tell you, before you even start with your recommendations, Corby, my view is all anybody needs 12 months a year is a good crockpot cookbook, and you're all set. What do you say to that?
I say you can buy my Pleasures of Slow Food, my second book, and find non-crockpot recipes that will last you the rest of your life. Yes.
When did that come out?
Write that down.
Gosh, 2012?
Can I tell you something? I will own it by the end of this day. I'm totally serious. I will own it by the end of the day. So give us recommendations for different kinds of people at different levels of cooking skills. What's the right book for the right person?
Oh, okay. So different levels of cooking skills. I'm very glad you asked that. I'm dipping into my book for Chop Chop. So this is a magazine started by the local extremely accomplished Sally Sampson, nonprofit quarterly on how to cook with families. So it disguises itself as a completely multicultural, elementary, here's what we do for children. But what it really does is teach every family how to cook.
This is fabulous. I'm reading as you're talking. It's simple. Great illustrations. It's terrific.
Hold on. Did you do that with your children? I did not, and I suppose because I don't cook well enough really to teach them. But, I mean, did you do that with your kids, being a fine cook?
Oh, you know, I was ridiculous. I would try to teach children how to roll their own pizza dough. And how to make their own pizza dough and wait 2 hours. You know, it's only 2 hours. It's not like overnight for regular rises. So, you know, I was ridiculous. This is much more elementary and what kids actually eat.
Can
That's
I tell you something?
Brilliant idea.
Before you go to the next one, I want to voice a complaint with your selections, even after one book, and I hope you don't take this personally.
We're starting.
No, a cookbook has to have a spiral binder. When you, a spiral, what is the nut binder? What's that thing called?
Bound, yeah.
Loose leaf.
No, the problem is any of these cookbooks that you open, unless you put something to weigh down pages on both sides, it collapses on you, doesn't it? Isn't that an issue?
You put a hairbrush in the middle.
Was that what you do?
No, I put other books. And it's constantly, or you get one of those plastic cookbook stands. But the great thing about cookbooks is, first of all, people still like cooking for them, not from iPads, which get incredibly greasy when you get them wet. It's one of the few things where people actually want pages. And they get sauce-stained pages. And for sauce-stained pages, we have Sauces and Shapes, a great book about pasta. By two pasta scholars who have distilled exactly the sauces you need to know about for pasta. It's an everyday, it's scholarly, it's authentic, but it's also completely usable. And it's what you will make every night.
Do you know Marjorie is writing down every single word?
Writing
she is.
Down.
She's writing down every
hope
word.
Hope springs eternal that I one day will become a good cook.
But by the way, at the end of the show at WGBHnews.org, there'll be a list of everything that Corby's mentioned. But Corby, since you blew that complaint out of the water, let me try one more and then I'm going to shut up.
Go ahead.
This looks great.
Even if it turns... So, okay, so you use a cookbook stand. I guess that does resolve that problem. But the other problem for those of us who are sort of novice cooks, when the recipe does not end on the page that you're working on and have to flip the page, it's not fair. Would you agree with that?
I would agree that it's not fair when a recipe is so short that you have to be a good cook to figure out how to make it work. Mm. And that is the problem with a lot of recipes. So I brought in a beautiful bearded Brooklyn book. There's a whole subcategory of bearded Brooklyn books because there are all these hipsters. They all have long beards. I wrote about two of them in the Atlantic.com's Roundup, which is where this runs. So here's a beautiful marble cheesecake brownies recipe with a gorgeous photograph from the Mast Brothers Chocolate Family Cookbook. So Mast Brothers, you see this beautiful handmade
book leaf
paper. They have the most gorgeous packaging. They themselves are craggly, handsome, Midwestern, long-bearded brothers.
They have a million
videos on their
line. Okay, I have to see the handsome
brothers. So they're a local cult, and it's a very beautiful book. And there are things like chocolate sauces and easy truffles, you know, candies that you make yourself that are going to be easy to make.
I don't know. They look a little like serial killers to me. I'm not sure.
Yeah, they're less ominous looking in person and on their videos.
Okay. What's the name of that one again? That is a beautiful book.
The Mast Brothers Chocolate Family Cookbook. As I say in the Atlantic.com, every year needs some chocolate porn. So this is the chocolate porn. There's also a great book by Alice Medrich, perhaps the top chocolate educator in the country. Yes, there is a category of those. And she's come out with Seriously Bittersweet, which is a great teaching book and a great chocolate book for those lovers.
By the way, the books you have brought, that is beautiful. It's beautifully bound. The photographs are absolutely beautiful. Mm-hmm. The print, it really is a beautiful book.
Yeah.
Now,
Best of Brooklyn.
Corby Kummer, expert food writer and chef and writer for Atlantic Magazine and many other publications. You write for Boston Magazine all the time, too.
I'm a restaurant critic, thank goodness.
If people are trying to be more healthy and they want to get a cookbook, you know, that's not going to be ladled with, you know, heavy cream and stuff like that, is there a new one from 2013 that you would recommend?
Well, yeah. I mean, but this is like not simple. It's called Pak Pak, and it's Thai food, and
it's complicated. Okay. Forget that.
There's no cream in it. There's no cream in it. But it is fantastically interesting. It's full of vegetables and stir fries, lots of chili sauces. For every adventurous ethnic cook, this is probably the book of the year.
P-O-K, P-O-K.
Right. Written by a guy named Andy Ricker, a very accomplished chef who had a cult restaurant of the name Pak Pak in Portland, Oregon. And it was such a cult that it has transferred to New York City. You know something's really made it if it's been in Portlandia and then
that's true.
To New York.
Now, I have another question.
Keep going.
There was a book that came out by Mark Bittman. He writes about food for the New York Times, about how to cook everything, about a year ago. It was 2 years ago. It was great because it was for people that didn't know how to cook anything. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like the joy of cooking. Is there a kind of book like that that's a good gift for people that are just, you know, new brides or something like that?
Well, so I would say that Chop Chop, which is geared for kids,
supposedly,
is incredibly basic and elementary. And that's why I think it's in disguise. It's a great teaching book for grown-ups,
terrific,
too, for every day and every night meals that are designed to be healthy, because the hidden purpose of it is get kids eating fresh food and don't get them fat. I mean, it has a big... It has a big underlying agenda. There's nothing preachy about it. You wouldn't know from the incredible, cheerful, multicultural, beautiful color pictures there are. But that is probably the kind of health food book of the year.
You know, while you are talking about people who are some of the great cookbook recipe writers or good cookbook writers, there also is an art to the photograph of food. A friend of mine who actually died about a year ago, was my best friend in college, Michael Abramson, was a great food photographer. He was brilliant. I'm looking at the cover of the Joanne Chang book, the new book that came out. Mm-hmm. I think it's new. Is it not Flower 2?
Yes.
T-O-O. The photographs are just totally beautiful.
They're stunning.
They really are stunning. And there is a huge, I guess it's fairly obvious, there's an art to this.
Helen Turkel. So in the roundup, I didn't bring it in, there's this weird Brooklyn cookbook that I have just for the photographs. It's by two guys who have a blog called The Way We Ate. The book is called The Way We Ate. It's the weirdest, most confusing conceit of for every year of the 20th century, they'll take one historical riff, you know, whether it's Prohibition, so it gives a great drink, whether it's the opening of South Pacific in some enchanted evening. I mean, it's just, you can't really tell. But because they are such talented and in-demand food photographers, they got every kind of famous foodie in New York to contribute. So there's whole list. There's this raft of New York chefs and great food people who are doing these okay, odd, eccentric recipes. But the photographs are stunning. And you are seeing this is the food world and what the food world is looking at.
How is the Joanne Chang was in here a couple of months ago, I think for a quiz, I'm not sure. But she's local and we're big on local. You're local. How is the Joanne Chang book?
Oh, it's so good.
Why?
Oh, good.
So because it's not, well, because everything Joanne Chang does is pleases crowds, is kind of field tested. You can't go into one of the four locations of Flower without waiting in line. The one in Back Bay, where I'm often waiting before the train, is amazingly crowded. She's such a good marketer.
So is Cambridge on Mass Ave near where
Absolutely.
I live all the time.
Yeah, I'll probably be there later this afternoon. So why is it so good? Because she uses such fresh ingredients and she has twists to everything. So there's the winter salad. You just opened it to a farmer's
Photograph.
Market
it's
salad.
Just perfect.
My spouse had this fabulous salad of the Fort Point Channel and said, everything was so fresh. Why is her stuff just so much better? Because they pay attention to ingredients. It's simple. There's this egg sandwich. If you've ever had the egg sandwich, it's kind of like a baked omelet that's easy to make. You cut it into squares. You layer it with cheddar and tomatoes, and you put it on her focaccia bread, which she tells you how to make.
Ah.
There are these simple tomato soups. It's a general cookbook, and it shows you why it's so popular. She shares all her secrets. And as you say, there's, you know, everything you
Wait
open to, you want to eat, right? Roasted pork.
What's that
pie.
Called? What's that called?
Flower 2,
T-O-O.
Okay.
So the first book was Flower.
Audrey is writing as you're speaking.
Well, you know, I went to the Brookline Booksmith, which is a bookstore in Coolidge Corner.
As well as you should.
Independent, I should say.
And as well you should.
I was stunned because I don't know if this is just something special for Christmas, but I walked in there and all the cookbooks are right in the front of the store. So I presume that that's because these are huge for Christmas. That
it's
people
because
just,
they have good taste.
Yeah, probably because they have good taste.
They
right?
have
Usually they
selection.
Have the hardcover bestsellers there in the front and the new hardcover fiction, but they had all the cookbooks and they were I was overwhelmed. So that's why I'm so happy
to see. Is this where cookbook writers make most of their money? I assume Christmas is absolutely huge, is it not?
Yeah, no, I'm sure it's where they make most of their money.
So are you giving any cookbooks for the holiday, for
Christmas?
Well,
I'm giving lots of review copies that I have. And I have to keep, you know, I have to keep a lot that I have.
Well, tell us about your book. The Pleasures of Slow Food was a while ago now.
And The Joy of Coffee, which is in a revised edition, which is how to
Wonderful.
Make and brew coffee. Everything about it to make it really simple. And who doesn't love coffee, including your previous guest?
Wasn't he great?
Yeah,
during
he
the
was great.
23rd Psalm with
Tim
caffeine.
Skank, Reverend Skank, yeah.
Oh, listen, I have to plug something else. The late editor of The Atlantic wrote a book called Things That Matter, I think. But the main essay was about colored lights. And it was called Colored Lights. And he said, I am a colored lights man. We live in a white lights neighborhood, which is Swampscott unnamed. And those boys are still going very strong in Swampscott. They're just the greatest family.
Who's and the late editor of
the great
Atlantic?
Michael Kelly.
Oh, Michael Kelly. Oh, of course.
Michael Kelly, yeah. Just a wonderful guy, a wonderful writer, and will always be remembered. So the minute you say colored lights, I think Mike Kelly and his terrific boys.
So can you do a little – you give us a broad array of cookbooks from sauces to chocolate. Oh, book. Do this one. And then I'm going to ask you to make three recommendations for people who are just overwhelmed. Go ahead.
So this is a book I'm completely tickled by called The Book of Schmaltz. It's by a non-Jew named Michael Ruhlman, who had a great Jewish neighbor in Cleveland who taught him how to love schmaltz. And it's how to make schmaltz, which is rendered chicken fat from skin with onions, and then put it in things like matzah balls and knishes and oatmeal cranberry cookies.
I've never even heard of that.
And
schmaltz,
soup
you never
and
heard
consomme.
Of?
No.
Marjorie, we are giving you an ethnic education today.
Are.
From Thai to schmaltz. What he doesn't mention is schmaltz in Eastern Europe means pork fat, which for Jews who were raised on it comes as a very rude shock. And there's a new restaurant in Union Square, Somerville, where schmaltz indeed means pork fat. So you have to get used to it. Bronwyn.
So are you going to be upset if I say her people on a last minute 1 week to go rush? Give them three at the top. I know you love them all.
Yeah, I
what
do
would
love
your
them
three
all.
Top recommendations
oh,
be?
Oh gosh, sauces and shapes for pasta, chop chop for families, and as elementary cooking that's healthy. Pak Pak for the food fanatic who loves ethnic food. It's such an interesting Thai book. And for the chef on your list, Flower too, because we all love Joanne Chang and it's so accessible and so good. And for the obsessive, I want to be a chef, there's a book called Manresa, M-A-N-R-E-S-A. There's a guy named David Kinch in California who is a chef. Go around the world, and people who really know food all have their eye on David Kinch. He's never written a book before, and it's a fascinating look into the avant-garde of food and cooking.
You must be a great cook.
I'm a good cook.
Why do you never bring anything for us, by the way?
Okay, so all right. I've got to correct this now. Because I'm a restaurant critic and I buy stuff and I eat incredibly simply.
We have 45 seconds.
But I feast on reading cookbooks, and there's great reading this year also.
I'm psyched.
Corby,
I'm psyched.
We love you. Thank
I'm
you
ready
so
to go
much
back to the
in.
Brookline Booksmith and make my purchases. Corby Kummer is a senior editor at The Atlantic and an award-winning food writer and also a great cook. Corby, thank you so much for coming
Thanks,
in.
Corby.
And thank you to all you guys for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow for Open Mic with Alex Beam from the Boston Globe, who is always a riot. Governor Deval Patrick will be here on Friday. Our show is a production of WGBH Boston Public Radio. Our team is Chelsea Murs, Will Roselip, John Parker, and Amanda McGowan. I am Marjorie Egan.
You know who's supposed to be a great cook, by the way?
Who?
Deval Patrick. We'll
That's
talk
right.
to him about that. It's right before Christmas. I'm Jim Browdy.
Osabuca or something like that?
Osabuca is
his
signature
close.
Dish.
Thanks for listening.